wonderful to have such a full house, and if we need to, we will be getting some more chairs, I think, so please stand at the back, or there's two seats at least at the front, in the front row down here. So, good afternoon, everybody, colleagues, professorial fellows, a few in the room, friends from the profession and government, honoured guests and students. I'd like to acknowledge that we meet today on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to elders past and present. For those who don't know me, I'm Miranda Stewart. I'm a professor here and currently Director of Tax Studies and the Tax Group here at Melbourne Law School. So it's wonderful to invite you to our 14th annual tax lecture. Before I say a little bit about the lecture and our speaker for the lecture, I first of all wanted to just do a little bit of an introduction about our 2020 tax program, which we're really pleased has now been finalised and is available. Many of you will know that, of course, we have a very large tax masters program here, part of the general Melbourne Law Masters. The whole Melbourne Law Masters program has been released today, in this last month. What I want to do especially is to express my profound gratitude to the many colleagues in the tax profession, many of whom are here this evening, from leading accounting and law firms at the bar and in government agencies, as well as visiting academics, for the extraordinary contribution that they make to our Tax Masters program. It's the quality and engagement of our teachers combined with, I dare say, our small class sizes, wonderful curriculum, and face-to-face teaching that makes the program, I think, the best in Australia and one of the best in the world in this area. And each year, more than 25 senior fellows from the profession contribute to the program, so really we couldn't do it without you. In 2020, we continue our tradition of offering 20 specialist tax subjects in a variety of intensive and semester-long formats, core tax subjects, 8 advanced offerings, and 8 international and comparative subjects. You can take them singly as part of a master's or grad dip or without assessment. We offer 2 new advanced subjects next year that might interest members of this audience. One is administrative law in tax matters, and the other, income tax compliance and enforcement. I'm especially pleased that our speaker this evening, who I will introduce shortly, is also a senior fellow teaching with us. She's taught with us for more than a decade, and in 2020, Her Honour will be teaching one of our regular advanced subjects with others in the room, tax avoidance and planning, which I suggest is essential study these days. So, with that brief advertisement, welcome to the 14th annual tax lecture at the Law School, to be delivered by the Hon. Justice Jennifer Davies of the Federal Court of Australia. The annual tax lecture is the highlight of our tax event calendar at the school. The goal of the lecture series is to present speakers of the highest calibre to discuss tax law in its broader legal, social or economic context, and to address fundamental structural issues relating to taxation law. So the title of Tax Stability, I think you'll agree, is in keeping with that tradition. So our guest speaker this evening, the Hon. Justice Jennifer Davies, was appointed to the Federal Court of Australia in July 2013 and is the National Coordinating Judge of the Tax Practice Area. Justice Davies graduated from Monash University, we won't hold that against her, with a Bachelor of Jurisprudence and Bachelor of Laws. As noted before, I'm pleased to say she now teaches with us and also sits on the advisory board of the Tax Group and the Tax Masters Program. Justice Davies completed articles at Pavey, now Coors, and was admitted as a barrister and solicitor to the Supreme Court in Victoria, and working for 23 years as a barrister, taking Silk in 2004. At the bar, Her Honour was a highly regarded expert in corporations, commercial, administrative and tax law, and is a former member of the Law Council Taxation Committee, a founding member of the Women Barristers Association, president of the Tax Bar Association and chair of the Ethics Committee of the Victorian Bar. Her Honour was appointed to the Victorian Supreme Court in 2009, where she served for 4 years prior to the appointment to the Federal Court in 2013. I'm pleased to say that we've had numerous professional connections in recent years, relating especially in recent years to international tax. Justice Davies has a strong interest in international comparative tax law and has collaborated with the International Fiscal Association, including holding seminars at the Federal Court of Australia, which has been a great experience, and has built terrific connections with judicial, academic and professional tax colleagues across borders, including sitting on the board of the International Association of Tax Judges. And you know, not so very long ago, such an association really wouldn't have made any sense. But clearly in today's world, it does. So this international engagement, I think, is especially valuable to the tax profession and the court today, in this era of burgeoning international tax law norms, disputes and litigation. Her Honour's commitment to hiking, the open air and fitness is well known, and she has, I believe, stretched many colleagues and friends by walking straight up mountains, among other things. It seems perfect training for the lecture she's going to deliver today. So there'll be time at the end of the lecture for a few questions from the floor, and we'll then have a vote of thanks by a colleague here in the profession and at the law school, Mr. Frank O'Loughlin, QC. I should point out the event's being recorded, and I'm grateful to Her Honour for agreeing to that. And I believe that slides and speech will be available at some point after the event. So please join me in welcoming Justice Davies. Oh, no, I've now turned it off. There we go.
Thank you, Miranda, for that overly generous introduction. when I was preparing for this lecture, I was just looking for quotable quotes. And I came across this one from Albert Einstein, and it did impress me. If he thinks that tax is in that category, what hope do we have? The theme of this paper, Taxability, was prompted by the reflection that the paradigm tax case for judicial determination is shifting from the tax consequences of purely domestic transactions to taxation issues associated with cross-border transactions or involving international tax measures. We think of tax law as domestic law, which essentially it is, but we have moved from a domestic tax framework designed around local affairs to a complex tax design concerned with protecting Australia's tax base and guarding against the abuse of domestic tax rules in international dealings by the enactment of measures directed to bringing to tax within Australia's jurisdiction an appropriate share of tax revenue from international dealings. And nowadays, international tax law plays a much larger and significant role in the design of our domestic tax laws. In recent years, there have been many important and complex legislative changes to Australia's tax laws that responding to the rise of global trade and the digital economy. And with the globalisation of the economy and growth in intergroup trade, the complexity of Australia's tax laws related to international dealings has increased enormously in the effort to ensure that Australia receives its fair amount of tax on cross-border transactions. The years since 2013, the 2013 OECD Action Plan on Base Erosion and Profit Shifting in particular have seen a great deal of change with an explosion of legislation directed at international dealings and multinational companies. And I've listed, some of the key pieces of legislation in recent times, of which many of you are very familiar. The multinational anti-avoidance legislation, which came into effect on 1 January 2016, the diverted profits tax, which came into effect on 1 July 2017, the hybrid mismatch rules, which took effect from 1 January 2019, and also on 1 July 2019, the Multilateral Convention to Implement Capital Tax Treaty-related measures to prevent base erosion and profit shifting, otherwise known as the MLI, to which Australia became a signatory on the 7th of June 2017, and which has since come into force for Australia. And we have seen with these and other legislative measures a shifting from the traditional tax base of income and expenditure, profit and loss, to rights of taxation based on international standards, including anti-abuse measures that are designed to counter and prevent base erosion and profit shifting in Australia. In a paper titled Tax in a Changing World, the Second Commissioner, Andrew Mills, observed that change in tax has been the one consistent feature of the tax landscape for years. Frequent changes in tax laws to keep pace with the economic, social and commercial developments are not just to be expected. Change is an integral part of the tax regime and taxation reform is necessary. But constant tax law changes have an impact on tax stability. It is undoubted that the complexity of the recent changes to our tax laws presents a central challenge for tax stability. The changing tax environment and globalisation of tax policy also means that international tax law will take on much more importance. With the rapid internationalisation of Australia's tax laws, international tax practices and rules and international tax law jurisprudence will have much more significance and will have to be grappled with in the future development of the law. This paper will examine some of the challenges for certainty and consistency in the development of that law in the Australian context. It is a feature of business today that multinational groups have entities in more than one jurisdiction through which the group conducts its activities. Australia, like many other countries, has implemented tax reforms based upon internationally agreed fiscal standards. It might be thought that domestic law giving effect to internationally agreed fiscal standards intended to produce a cohesive global approach should mean certainty and uniformity between sovereign states in respect of the fiscal outcomes of an international dealing within a multinational group. But that proposition assumes that the domestic laws of the sovereign states are in harmony, and that is not a valid assumption to make. Whilst around 130 countries have collaborated through the OECD BEPS project on international tax rules designed to protect tax bases, the differing tax policies and revenue laws within each country necessarily govern the tax treatment and fiscal consequences of an international dealing in accordance with the particular domestic laws of the country concerned. Harmonisation of international rules and practices for the taxation of international dealings does not mean alignment of or consistency of tax outcomes for an international dealing. One example is here in Australia with our hybrid mismatch rules. Those rules include an integrity rule in subdivision 832J of the Income Tax Assessment Act 1997 that was not part of the OECD BEPS Action 2 recommendations. In a press release in November 2017, the then Treasurer explained that following, and I quote, following the introduction of the hybrid mismatch rules, multinational groups investing into Australia may seek to achieve double non-taxation outcomes by using investment structures and arrangements that may not fall within the scope of the OECD's hybrid mismatch rules. For example, foreign headquartered groups investing into Australia may use financing arrangements through interposed entities in zero tax countries which reduce Australian profits without those profits being subject to foreign tax. The government is concerned that such arrangements would undermine the integrity of the hybrid mismatch rules and will therefore be developing a targeted integrity rule to ensure that such arrangements cannot be used to circumvent the hybrid mismatch rules. That has consequences because immediately you have a distortion. You have a unilateral tax measure in one country that will bring about a taxation consequence in that country which is not consistent with what is occurring in the other country relating to the international dealings. So despite the global move towards the harmonised international tax law, fiscal outcomes in different jurisdictions may differ where there is a unilateral tax measure, an international tax measure that has been introduced. And a lack of cohesion and taxation treatment by sovereign states is an inevitable consequence of purely domestic considerations shaping tax measures. Thus, although international tax law is moving to a more uniform approach, each country through its own set of tax laws defines how and the extent to which those international tax laws will operate. Lack of cohesion in treaty interpretation is another potential source of inconsistent outcomes. The multilateral instrument and Australia's bilateral tax treaties form part of Australia's domestic law by Act of Parliament, but they are international agreements. And because they are international agreements, the interpretive principles applying to the construction of those treaties are not governed by the domestic principles of statutory interpretation, but by Articles 31 to 33 of the Vienna Convention on the Interpretation of Treaties. And I've put up on the board what those, on the PowerPoint, what those interpretive principles are. They look pretty easy to apply, don't they? Interpreting a treaty in good faith in accordance with the ordinary meaning to be given to the terms of the treaty in their context and in the light of its object and purpose. Well, what's difficult about that? Moreover, these rules codify the customary rules under international law for the interpretation of treaties, so that even with respect to bilateral treaties where neither country has adopted the rules of the convention, or where one country has but the other country has not, and one example is the United States has signed the convention but has not ratified it, there should not be a considerable difference in the general approach to the construction of international treaties. A common interpretation of tax treaties is important for tax stability. In Bywater Investments Limited against Commission of Taxation, Justice Gordon explained why, and I've extracted from her judgment what she said, but the critical point that Her Honour made was that the whole point of bilateral agreements, which is to prevent double taxation across two jurisdictions, would be frustrated if they were to be interpreted in a manner which would permit or foster conflicting outcomes between the two states in question. Thus, where possible, courts will interpret tax agreements to achieve consistency. But tax treaty interpretation is not always cohesive, despite the applicable interpretive principles recognised by international law applying to the construction of international treaties. There is no global jurisprudence, and the principle of judicial comity does not apply to a foreign decision on the construction of a treaty text. And though it might be assumed that the application of common rules to a bilateral or multilateral agreement should have the consequence of the agreement being interpreted similarly by the courts of the contracting states, it does not necessarily follow, and the results may not always be identical. Despite sovereign states ostensibly applying the same approach, the experience of both common law and civil law countries is that uniform interpretation rules have not led to uniformity of construction and harmonious global jurisprudence. A thorough analysis of the reasons why is well beyond the scope of this paper. There is a very considerable amount written on it, and it's quite complicated. But there are three aspects which I think it's useful to consider in this context. First, the application of uniform tax uniform rules, as I've mentioned, does not mean that there may not be differing views on the meaning of the text of the treaty. Just as the well-established and oft-repeated canons of statutory construction applying to domestic legislation can offer more than one construction. For those who were at one of the IFA sessions last year, you would have heard Judge Michael Busch from the Swiss Federal Administrative Court talk on this topic. He, in a paper that he wrote extrajudicially, His Honour observed that, quote, interpretation is as such not an exact science with only one solution. His Honour noted that the interpretive rules in the Vienna Convention cannot ensure a uniform application of tax treaties, and the outcome of an identical case can differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, even where the treaty in question is based on the OECD model and with the benefit of the OECD commentary on the model. Now, Judge Busch is a judge in Switzerland with considerable experience in the field of international law. Yet within Europe itself, where you would think there may at least be some uniform approach to the or consistency in treaty construction, it would appear that the experience of those countries is just as bad as the experience can be in Australia with the construction of treaties in a way that is consistent with the way in which other contracting states will have looked at that looked at the treaty. The reason is explicable. Treaty interpretation is not an easy task, and it is open to more than one meaning. Burden against Commission of Taxation is a local example of how differing views were reached by the full court of the Federal Court on the construction of Article 22.2 of the Double Tax Convention between Australia and the United States. And in that case, the taxpayer paid tax in the US on gains made from the sale of assets. The gains were also taxable in Australia and subject to the 50% capital gains tax discount. The dispute was whether the taxpayer was entitled to a tax offset or credit for the whole of the amount of the US tax which it had paid, or only 50% of that amount. The relevant article is on the PowerPoint. The majority, Justices Stewart and Jackson, held that the article only entitled the taxpayer to a credit in respect to 50% of the capital gain. Justice Logan dissented on the construction and effect of Article 22, Justice Logan, like Justice Stewart, was of the view that the construction he adopted was consistent with the text of the article, applying the interpretive principles in the Vienna Convention. Justice Stewart reasoned that the requirement that income be, quote, in respect of, unquote, or bear a nexus with Australian tax payable required an identification of the income that Australia taxes. And as Australia taxed only 50% of the gain, only half of the US paid was with respect to income taxed in Australia, and only half of the US tax paid could be credited against the tax payable. On Justice Logan's construction, neither the phrase in respect of nor the word on carried the meaning, quote, to the extent to which, unquote. In construing Article 22, His Honour also had regard to the OECD Model Tax Convention commentary, noting that the High Court decision in Teal against Commissioner of Taxation exemplified the appropriateness of reference to an OECD commentary for assistance in the construction of a double taxation agreement. Justice Stewart similarly referred to the OED model convention and commentary, but putting aside that the commentary was written some 12 years after that treaty was signed, But His Honour considered that the reference to that material was of no assistance, as the double tax agreement was based not only on the OECD model, but also on the United States Model Income Tax Convention. And it was not established that the two models were materially and relevantly the same. Thus, despite applying the same constructional rules, totally opposite constructions were reached. Secondly, second reason why it is that there is inconsistency in tax treaty interpretation relates to the fact, at least in Australia, there is not as much given not as much attention given to foreign case law as there should be. In interpreting tax treaties, courts will take into account how courts of other jurisdictions have interpreted the same or similar articles within the tax treaty in question. Judge Michael Bush similarly emphasised in his article that being in a truly global context, tax treaty interpretation should necessarily involve consideration of foreign case law, especially of the other contracting state to a tax treaty, as an aid to interpretation. His Honour observed that courts can but learn from taking into account and dealing with other courts' decisions. Turning again to a local example of the relevance of foreign law is the case of Tech Mahindra Limited against Commissioner of Taxation. That's an example of a case where a foreign authority should have been brought to the attention of the court, but it was not. That case concerned the interaction of Article 7, the Business Profits Rule, and Article 12, the Royalties Provision, of the Australia-India Double Tax Agreement. It was not brought to the attention of the full court that a full bench of the Indian Supreme Court, the highest court in India, had considered the construction of the same articles of the Japan-India Double Tax Agreement in relation to a not dissimilar factual scenario. Why it was not brought to the attention of the full federal court is an unknown. Whether it was known about, known by the commissioner beforehand, we never found out. It appears it was certainly not known, the taxpayer was not aware of it at the time of the full court hearing. But when it came to applying for special leave, ground number one supporting the application for special leave was that the decision of the full federal court was contrary to the decision of the Supreme Court of India. It is apparent from reading a transcript of the special leave application that it was the fact of a potentially inconsistent, fact of a potentially conflicting decision of a superior court of the other contracting state which caught the attention of the High Court, and it was a matter of keen interest to the High Court. In the event the High Court refused special leave, saying it was not persuaded there was in substance any conflict between the full court decision and the decision of the Supreme Court of India. In that case, the failure to make a reference to the Indian decision at an earlier stage than the High Court special leave application ultimately did not impact upon the result, but it could well have. And in other cases, reference to foreign case law could make an important and decisive difference in outcome. Decisions of foreign courts are of obvious relevance to the consideration of the interpretation to be given to a tax treaty, particularly if there is an authority from a superior court of the other contracting state that is directly on point. We have had authority since 1997 in the Federal Court decision of Commissioner of Taxation and Lamisa Holdings to the effect that where the construction of an international treaty arises, evidence as to the interpretation of that or subsequent treaties in one of the participating countries forms part of the matrix of material to which reference can properly be made in the appropriate case. The decision does not have to be from a court of the other contracting state to be relevant, and Australian courts are not restricted in the foreign case law to which they may have regard. Where there is a need to construe a tax treaty, Any foreign cases that have considered the same or like articles in the agreement can assist the court in the construction of the agreement. Such decisions will not be binding on an Australian court, but they can carry great weight and be highly persuasive. Factors which may bear on the persuasive value will include the status of the court, the degree of persuasiveness of the reasoning, textual differences in the agreement considered by the foreign case law, and the differences in statutes or law under which the foreign case was decided. In a case called Satyam Computer Services, which happens to be the sequel to Tex Mahindra, that's again a local example of a case where differences in domestic law led to conflicting results between the outcome in India and the outcome in Australia. In that case, Indian case law was relied on by the taxpayer to argue that the Commissioner's construction would have the consequence of the India-Australia double tax agreement applied inconsistently between the contracting states. The full court considered in that case the relevant Indian case law was brought to the attention of the full court, which it considered, but ultimately the full court did not follow the Indian authorities, holding that it was not the construction which the Commissioner urged which would produce that inconsistency, if there is one, but rather the effect of Australia's domestic laws in sections 4 and 5 on the international tax agreement that would produce that result. While Australian courts are not constrained in the foreign authorities to which they may have regard, the common law jurisdictions are rich sources of comparative law in Australia, particularly those of Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom and the United States, and they are often cited in tax cases. The jurisprudence of civil law countries is not referred to as much, partly because of jurisdictional differences, but also because of some basic difficulties, such as not being available in English, or any unofficial translations being available which were not sufficiently accurate to be reliable, or the simple problem of finding the relevant case law. Now, some of those basic difficulties are diminishing with the availability of global and accessible legal resources, and particularly in the area of international tax law, it can and should be expected that Australian courts will look more and more to civil law jurisprudence as well as common law cases for assistance and guidance. To have a look at an example of a case where authorities were considered by the High Court, which were not the normal group of authorities that we would commonly have regard to, is McCoon against Commissioner of Taxation. that case didn't directly involve a question of international tax law, but it did involve a question as to whether or not legislation in Australia was considered with the immunities provided for by the Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the Specialised Agencies. And in the course of that consideration, the High Court had regard to the practice of other state parties to the agency's convention, which it stated must be considered. in looking at those the authorities of the other states, the decisions which the court had regard to included decisions of courts in France, the Netherlands, a decision of an arbitral tribunal constituted by the government of the French Republic, and the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, and a judgment of the Administrative Tribunal of the United Nations. So it really is a look outside the square kind of analysis. A third issue relating to treaty interpretation concerns the problem of language. Double tax agreements often use words differing from terms found in domestic legislation or which have no clear or certain meaning under domestic law. For example, the construction issues in Teal's case concern the interpretation to be given by an Australian court to the words, quote, profits of an enterprise of one of the contracting states, unquote. in Article 7 of the Australia-Swiss double tax agreement, where the words enterprise and profits had no particular or established meaning under the laws relating to Australian income tax. Tax treaties can also use terms that have no meaning under domestic law, such as the concept of beneficial ownership, which is not recognised by the domestic laws of many civil countries. A further consideration is that a bilateral agreement is often written in the language of each of the contracting states, but in Australia only the English text is enacted as part of Australian law. And although by Article 33 of the Vienna Convention the text is equally authoritative in each language, the equivalent wording in the text can bear entirely different connotations, and as a consequence, textual divergences may be overlooked, and sovereign states may construe and apply provisions differently. As a result, just relying upon the words of the English version of the treaty may give rise to an interpretation that does not reflect the common intentions of the contracting states. In Teal's case, the majority noted that the meaning of enterprise might have been ascertained by evidence of the meaning of the corresponding German text, as the English and German texts of the agreement were agreed to be equally authoritative, but no such evidence was given, and the parties were unable to agree upon a translation of the German text. But it is important to remember that in Australia, expert evidence on the meaning of the corresponding text is admissible to assist in construing the relevant article. And for example, in Lamisa Holdings, expert evidence was given on the meaning and interpretation of the Dutch language version of the Netherlands-Australia double tax agreement. This is a really important consideration as to whether or not you may wish to obtain evidence on the meaning of the corresponding text when you are looking at treaty construction. Another important issue for consideration in the context of looking at international tax laws is the increasing integration of international soft law into Australia's tax laws, posing a number of questions as to how those taxes apply. Now, soft law is a term used to describe principles which have no legally binding force, but which nevertheless may have significance. In Australia, sources of international law include the OECD Model Conventions and Commentaries, the OEC Transfer Pricing Guidelines, and the commentaries on the MLI. Now, examples of the integration of soft law into Australian tax law include the transfer of pricing provisions in Division 815 of the Income Tax Assessment Act. Now, they provide that for the purpose of determining the effect of those provisions have in relation to an entity, the arm's length profits are to be worked out and the arm's length conditions are to be identified, quote, so as best to achieve consistency with, unquote, the Model Tax Convention on Income and Capital and its commentaries and the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. The development of the BEPS measures implemented by the MLI also included the development of commentary intended to be used in the interpretation of the rules of the MLI. The explanatory memorandum, a statement to the MLI, states that as the object and purpose of the MLI is to implement the tax treaty related BEPS measures, the commentary has particular relevance in the interpretation of the articles of the MLI. A third example is that the explanatory memoranda to many of Australia's double tax agreements make express reference to the OECD model commentary to inform the interpretation and application of an article or articles. You can just see by those three examples how what an important role that soft law now plays in Australia's tax laws in defining the scope and application of tax treaties as well as transfer pricing provisions. Problem is that soft law such as the OECD commentary are often very generally expressed. They can lack clarity in expression and can be deliberately uncertain. They are also not static, but they are revised and updated with regularity, and revisions can entail significant changes, such as the 2017 edition of the OECD Transfer Pricing Guidelines for multinational enterprises and tax administrations. The commentary of the OECD model, nonetheless, is often referred to by the courts in interpreting terms in treaties. But there is little Australian jurisprudence on, and the courts in Australia have yet to grapple directly with the question of the use of the versions of the commentary not existing at the time a treaty was signed as an interpretive tool in respect of that treaty. Now, that question may not be particularly contentious or matter where later versions do not conflict with the commentaries in existence at the time a specific treaty was entered into, but the role and relevance, if at all, of commentaries published later than a treaty, where the new commentary updates but departs from the commentary applying at the time of making the treaty, is far from settled. And it is likely in the future that the question of the use which can be made of and the weight to be attributed to soft law sources will become a significant issue for consideration and determination in tax cases. The presence and growing importance of foreign law as part of Australia's tax laws is another factor presenting challenges. For example, both the hybrid mismatch rules and the diverted profits tax provisions require consideration of two bodies of law, namely the Australian provisions and the foreign tax law consequences of a particular transaction. What that means is that in applying the Australian law, the foreign tax law consequences must first be worked out. There is a presumption inherent in those provisions that the relevant foreign tax law and foreign tax law consequences are readily ascertainable and not controversial. However, working out the foreign law tax consequences is unlikely either to be straightforward or to be definitive. First, the foreign law must be ascertained. Merely identifying relevant provisions bearing on the taxation questions is unlikely to be sufficient to resolve the taxation treatment. Relevant case law must also be considered, and in the absence of relevant case law, a view will have to be formed about the likely application of the provisions. Secondly, how is foreign court case law established? Well, the content and operation of foreign law is a question of fact. As explained by the High Court in Nielsen against Overseas Projects Corporation of Victoria Limited, the courts of Australia are not presumed to have any knowledge of foreign law. Decisions about the content of foreign law create no precedent. That is why foreign law is a question of fact to be proved by expert evidence. Well, proving foreign law has its own complexities. It has to be proved by expert evidence. That should cause warning bells for most of it. It can also be proved by the production of books or other materials in the manner prescribed by sections 174 and 175 of the Evidence Act, but without the assistance of evidence from a suitably qualified expert in that field of foreign law on how to interpret the provisions, proof by such means may not have utility. Expert evidence about foreign law, like any other form of expert evidence, also presents questions about the limits to which evidence may be adduced from an expert witness. Whilst the content and operation of foreign law is a question of fact on which expert evidence is admissible, the application of the foreign law to the facts of the particular case is a question of law for the court to determine, and it is not a matter for evidence. In Allstate Life Insurance against ANZ, Justice Lindgren gave explained why that is so, and essentially it's to do with the curial function of the court. It is the court's function to decide how it is that the proper application of the facts to the law, that is not a matter for expert evidence. In the case of foreign law, there is a variation because foreign law can only be proved in the way in which facts are proved, and that is it's necessary to adduce expert evidence on that. But how the foreign law is to be applied by the court is a matter for the court, not the expert, to opine on. There is a provision in the Evidence Act, Section 80, which provides that evidence of an opinion is not inadmissible only because it is about an ultimate issue. Justice Lindgren and Allstate thought those words were not apt to refer to expert evidence which impinges on the essential curial function of applying the law, whether domestic or foreign, to fact. So far, everything's clear and established, but in a New South Wales Supreme Court decision of Idaport Proprietary Limit against National Australia Bank, Justice Einstein drew a distinction between cases where the expert evidence of the application of the foreign law would impinge on the essential curial function and those where it did not. His Honour stated that if the court was concerned with foreign law as a subsidiary fact necessary to determine the rights and liabilities of the parties under the foreign law, then the receipt of evidence of foreign law experts as to the effect of foreign law did not usurp the function of the court. Whether there is in fact a tension between Allstate and Idaport is another matter that no doubt will arise for future judicial consideration in a tax case. We are fortunate that the distinction between content and application evidence has been held not to preclude an expert from examining in evidence how a discretion would be exercised by a foreign court, and thus if the relevant law involves the exercise of a discretion, the expert evidence can include evidence about the factors bearing upon the exercise of that discretion by a foreign court. Further consideration to bear in mind is that in the absence of expert evidence on the operation of foreign law or satisfactory proof, there is a general presumption that foreign law is the same as Australian law. That presumption has been described as general but not universal. Damberg against Damberg is a case where the court refused to assume that the relevant foreign law was the same as the Australian tax law. The foreign law in question in that case was German law on the avoidance or evasion of capital gains tax. And in the view of the court, the assumption that the German law was to the same effect of Australian law could not legitimately be made. Justice Hayden stated at paragraph 16, that 163, that, quote, taxation law cannot be assumed to be a field resting on great and broad principles likely to be part of any given legal system, unquote. Proof of foreign law thus is a matter of some importance. A taxpayer asserting that the foreign law does not apply in a way that would enliven the application of the hybrid mismatch rules has the onus to prove the relevant content of the foreign law. And such evidence might need to include evidence about the relevant rules of statutory construction to apply, because in the absence of contrary evidence, an Australian court would approach the task of construing the relevant tax law relevant foreign provision as it would approach the construction of an Australian statute. But there is a caution given by Justices Gummow and Hayne in Nielsen against overseas projects, where they stated at paragraph 115 that an English translation of the text of a foreign written law is not necessarily to be construed as if it were an Australian statute. Not only is there difficulty presented by translation of the original text, different rules of construction may be used in that jurisdiction. Moreover, where foreign law is in a language other than English, the need for translation may complicate, further complicate, the proof of that law. in Nielsen, Justice Kirby referred to, quote, the nuances and difficulties that existed because of the need to translate the Chinese law into the English law, English language, unquote. The value of any expert evidence on the foreign law consequences will also depend upon the adequacy of the proof and whether the evidence is proved in a meaningful way. Merely referring to provisions without analysis or explanation is unlikely to be helpful. Similarly, citing cases that are too generalised is unlikely to provide meaningful guidance on the applicable principles. Compounding the difficulties is that our own case law demonstrates how reasonable minds can legitimately reach very different conclusions on matters of construction and application, even in areas where the principles are well settled. So thus we are find ourselves in a position now where foreign law is an integer of some of our provisions in relation to tax consequences of international dealings, where just a short review of the processes one needs to go down in order to work out what that foreign law is a hornet's nest of problems. The need to rely upon expert evidence to determine tax issues in international dealings is not confined to proof of foreign law. And for example, although the fundamentally simple idea of the transfer pricing provisions is that an international non-arm's length dealing between related parties is to be taxed on the basis of the arm's length equivalent dealing of the actual transaction entered into, not upon actual profits or expenditure, the ascertainment of the arm's length price will often involve the consideration of matters involving specialist knowledge, such as economics, finance, or valuation. Expert opinion evidence has thus become an important aspect of tax cases, with courts increasingly reliant upon experts to inform them of the matters of specialist knowledge which it is necessary to have in order to apply the law. Many tax disputes involve expert evidence because of the non-legal nature of the subject matter which must be considered in order to decide the case. And whilst the law has developed rules and procedures for use of expert evidence, there are many problems with expert evidence, as the case law demonstrates. Now, some of those problems arise because of the sheer complexity of the subject matter of the expert evidence. You should feel some sympathy for my former colleague, Justice Begoni, in the RCF4 case, where His Honour had to deal with five experts producing two expert reports in relation to valuation of mining interests, where there was substantial disagreement about the appropriate methodology, valuation methodology to adopt. His Honour made some observations at paragraph 112, which I think he expressed in very measured terms, the difficulty that the courts face in trying to weigh competing expert evidence and come to a conclusion. Now, tax laws which depend for their application upon the ascertainment of facts which are matters of specialist knowledge are problematic. And the increasing need to rely upon specialist knowledge poses particular problems for courts, which must receive evidence in a form that can be understood and applied by judges. Expert evidence that's not presented in a plain and clear way or does not make complex concepts easily understandable to the judge or not supported by comprehensive reasoning can distort the fact-finding process by the judge, either excluding or misapprehending the expert evidence. The problems with expert evidence are not new. The court partly sought to address those problems by using the concurrent evidence process, which has had mixed results. Thinking about all these issues related to expert evidence and complexities, it seems to me that perhaps the time has come to reignite the debate about whether there should be an independent specialist tribunal modelled along the lines of the Australian Competition Tribunal, to hear tax cases involving the need to consider matters requiring specialist knowledge. Such a tribunal would have legal and non-legal members, with the non-legal members suitably qualified and experienced in areas such as economics, finance and valuation, who would be able to bring their expertise and knowledge into understanding and weighing competing expert testimony upon which the outcome of the tax case must depend. A procedure which doesn't appear to have had traction in tax controversies yet, but which is also worthy of consideration where competing expert evidence is involved, is the appointment of an independent person with specialist expertise in the discipline concerned as a referee in accordance with Section 54, capital A of the Federal Court of Australia Act. Now, such a referee can be appointed by the court to inquire and to report to the court on matters the subject of the expert evidence. In undertaking that task, the referee does not exercise delegated judicial power, and the referee's report is not binding on the court. The court might choose to adopt the report in whole or in part, or vary or reject it. There are a couple of useful cases. Where this process is referred to. One is Kadam against Me Resorts Group, One Proprietary Limited, where Justice Lee helpfully sets out the background to the use of referees. Kadam was not a tax case, but topically for this paper, His Honour there appointed a referee to inquire and report to the court on a question of foreign law in circumstances where there was conflicting expert evidence. In Commission of Taxation against Karate, which is a tax case, Justice Golvin used the referee procedure to determine whether documents were properly the subject of legal professional privilege. Tax cases may in future lead themselves to greater and wider use of the referee practice and procedure as another mechanism for facilitating an efficient resolution of the tax dispute, and it's something that I would commend to practitioners to think about in the presentation of their evidence. Coming to the end, you'll be pleased to know, I can see that my former colleague fortunately doesn't have a bottle of water, because otherwise he might carry out his threat to throw it at me, because he can still hear me. So I shall conclude quickly. Now, I've addressed some of the challenges in interpreting and applying international tax law measures. These challenges are not unique to Australia. They're common amongst in other countries, both civil law and common law countries. But there are five concluding points that I wish to make. First, tax law framed on international standards is not novel, but construing and applying provisions based on international tax law standards should not be regarded as a purely mechanical task of statutory construction. It is important to understand the principles informing the international standards and practice underpinning many of the tax measures adopted by Australia, and to consider how international tax reform has shaped many of these legislative measures. An understanding of the underlying policy frameworks will be an essential first step in construing and applying these new measures. And it is reasonable for courts to assume and to expect that appropriate assistance will be provided to the courts in that task by all relevant material being brought to the attention of the court. Such material will be useful not necessarily to control meaning, but as an aid to construction by providing relevant context for the consideration of the interpretational arguments. Secondly, it is also important to consider how international tax law intersects with Australia's tax laws. As the body of international tax law develops and expands, it becomes more and more important to be aware of the jurisprudence and learning on international tax law, and to draw on that jurisprudence for assistance and guidance. In any case involving international tax questions, relevant international jurisprudence and learning can be informative and in some cases highly influential in resolving the tax outcomes. It is thus again reasonable for the courts also to expect that it will be informed not just of the relevant principles to apply but of any comparative foreign jurisprudence. Thirdly, due to the increased coordination and adoption of international tax law principles, the body of relevant international tax law jurisprudence is likely to increase substantially as more and more countries look to foreign case law for assistance and guidance. Fourthly, tax stability depends on predictability and consistency of outcomes. The OECD report on tax certainty noted that one of the issues for creating uncertainty in this area is the time that it takes for courts to hand down landmark decisions directing what the law is. The time taken for cases to be heard and determined is a constant challenge for the court. Complex cases are both time-consuming to prepare for hearing and time-consuming to decide. That's why we have our case management tools. They're a very important asset in endeavouring to bring cases on for hearing more quickly than otherwise, and also to assist the court in narrowing down what the issues truly are in dispute, so that we can endeavour to get to work towards handing down our decisions in a more timely fashion. Final point is that courts have an important essential role in promoting tax stability in another way, and that is through the development of a body of jurisprudence, both domestic and international, which provides guidance and certainty on the applicable legal principles. In Australia, the jurisprudence is still relatively small and young, but as more and more tax cases involving international tax law issues are decided, judicial precedent will offer greater predictability and certainty as to the meaning and application. Before I move away from the lectern, there's one further thing that I wish to add, and it's a thank you to Gareth Redenbach for the time and effort and assistance that he provided me in looking at the issues concerning proof of foreign law, and I'm very grateful for the assistance that you gave me, Gareth. Thank you.
So thank you very much for that fantastic speech and very thought-provoking and detailed, which of course is what tax is always like. I think that in the circumstances, we probably won't take questions. Her Honour did not go over time. We started late. I'm sure that if you have a burning issue you'd like to take up with Her Honour, she'd be very happy if you can catch her in the few minutes after the lecture to talk to you about that. What I would like to do is introduce Mr. Frank O'Loughlin, QC, who's going to give the vote of thanks this evening. Frank is well known to many of you, worked for 12 years, for many years with the Tax Office and with Coors Chambers Westgarth as a partner before heading to the bar. Fairly recently took silk at the bar. A big fan and is a member of the AAT. It doesn't want any further introduction, but I should importantly say that he's a really fantastic contributor to this law school and to the Tax Masters. He's been a stalwart of our program for many years. We rely heavily upon him, and we're very grateful to have his good cheer and detailed tax teaching and ideas in the program. He sits on our advisory board as well, so he will give a vote of thanks, and I will pass over a small...
Your Honour, thank you, Miranda. I really shouldn't let this moment pass without observing that two-thirds of the people behind the microphone tonight are Monash graduates. And the other one's not even Melbourne, an inclusive university. Since 2005, the law school has convened the annual tax lecture. And through this series of lectures, it has brought to the podium profoundly experienced experts from Australia and abroad who have reflected on various taxation topics in a holistic and systemic way that is not ordinarily brought to the fore in dispute resolution processes or when governments introduce initiatives to advance their budgetary or economic or social welfare agendas. So before tonight, the law school has had the privilege of hearing holistic and or systemic reflections on bits and pieces of the tax system, both here and abroad, from an impressive cast, including or comprising two Cambridge University professors, one Oxford University professor, who was also a leading English silk, one New York University professor, three justices of the High Court, three justices of the Federal Court, one also a justice of the Supreme Court, and two of Australia's most experienced senior counsel. The topics that have been delivered from this podium have included the law of contracts, companies and trusts as criteria for tax, taxation in the Federal Court, past, present and future, the Commonwealth taxing powers and its limits, are we there yet, tax uncertainty, tax avoidance in the High Court since Sir Garfield Barwick, and last year's offering, fragmentation of the income tax in the 21st century, tax treaties as dark matter, whatever that means. This year, the law school has maintained its form. It has secured a profoundly experienced tax person, in her honour, who comfortably joins the company of those who have preceded her. Her honour has also addressed us on a contemporary topic of critical importance to the maintenance of a healthy tax system, and ultimately acceptance of and adherence to the rule of law through which we enjoy a better and safer community than otherwise might be the case. Our historical tax systems indeed face unprecedented challenges as business and banking methods alter in ways unimagined when significantly all of the tax legislation that we have had its genesis. The legislative and statutory interpretation developments we've journeyed through tonight are a perfect reflection of a new world of digital communication and business and banking methods, easy movement of capital, assets and management across vast corporations across borders, and cryptocurrencies. The framers of the 97 and 1936 Assessment Acts could possibly have dreamt of these features when they did their thing. Similarly, those asked to interpret statutes historically have not done so in that kind of setting. All countries, Australia included, face great challenges in ensuring continuance of certainty and consistency in the application of Australia's tax laws. In that setting, it is valuable to have Your Honour's insights into what some of those challenges might be and how those challenges might be met. From one Monash graduate to another, Your Honour, on behalf of everyone here tonight and on behalf of the university, thank you.